You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Wednesday morning, we've had 2 days of the Judge Jackson hearings. I don't think there's any real suspense here. I think every Democrat's going to support her. Manchin has been positive. The only drama is, you know, if and how many Republicans will jump on board. And, you know, my own sense is the more controversial she gets, the less likely you'd get Republican votes. Where, I mean, I think all things being equal, a bunch of Republicans probably would vote for her just to say, hey, we did.
And it's they have before, right? I mean, she's been through 3 Senate confirmation hearings, and I think she's gotten bipartisan support.
Well, she only got 3 last time when she was put on the appellate circuit. I think that was Collins, Murkowski, and Graham. And now Graham's being a little pissy about stuff these days.
Well, Graham wanted the other nominee from South Carolina, who would have gotten certainly Senator Scott. And Graham from South Carolina would have supported her.
Well, and he's pushing this notion that these left-wing groups wanted you and not the person I wanted. And that makes me wonder what they think, you know, you're going to do. And, I mean, you know, Graham's not an idiot. So I think he knows full well that Jackson is not, you know, bought and paid for by these groups. All sorts of crazy right-wing groups get behind Republican judges. Doesn't mean that they're going to do every last little thing that they say, and he doesn't raise an eyebrow about that.
Unfortunately, we found that out the hard way, Bill.
Yes. Well, exactly. I mean, once you're there, you do what you want. And if you want to worry about what you might do, look at her actual record.
Yeah. Actually, I should correct myself, because in the case of Donald Trump, I think that Republican, you know, failure to do what they're told was a good thing. The Republican nominees on the bench did a good job of standing up to Donald Trump, and I think that independence was very healthy. In other cases, I have been unhappy to see the way that they have grown on the bench.
Right. I mean, but that's the way the system is constructed. That's why you have the lifetime appointment.
Yeah, and that is the great thing about one of the great things about this country, right? Is that we have these checks and balances, and you know, once you are on the court, you are immune to a certain degree from pressure.
What sort of irks me is, I mean, I don't believe I'm being histrionic here, but there has been a, you know, years-long, decades-long process of building up a conservative infrastructure to not just encourage a president to pick a bona fide, you know, strict constructionist, but then to give that person air cover once they are nominated. The progressive network on that score pales in comparison.
Yeah. But in fairness, the reason Republicans built this infrastructure was because of, you know, Robert Bork.
Right.
But Democrats Borking, and then we've seen it with Clarence Thomas, and then most recently with Brett Kavanaugh, where I think that this infrastructure probably did serve to help buttress him and also to get like Amy Coney Barrett nominated. So it has been effective, but it was the result, I think, of necessity. You know, necessity was the impetus for this.
Be that as it may, we can talk about that stuff more if you like. Graham is really focused on this group Demand Justice, which is a new group. And, you know, there are a couple of progressive groups that have been around for a long time, like Alliance for Justice and American Constitution Society, that do some kind of work in this area, though, again, I don't think nearly as potent as what the right has built. Demand Justice is kind of a new kid on the block. And you know, they've pushed, you know, they're kind of showy, they're pushing court packing, they want to end the filibuster. But they're hardly a proven entity with any obvious political force. And it became kind of a thing on the left that Childs was too moderate and Jackson would be better, but hardly based on much information. It's more, it's like, there's one article about Childs that came up and everyone kind of like glommed out. That was the shiny object to get mad at. And Jackson was the other person, basically what it came down to, from my perspective. It's not like there's some like long list of like, you know, hardcore left-wing rulings that Jackson has that people are really holding up on the left. And it's pretty evident that she's going to get confirmed regardless. It's not like she's getting confirmed because Demand Justice has an ad campaign. Like, they're not the secret sauce why she's getting in. And for Graham to sort of hold them up to suggest that she is a political pick, I just think he's got to know better. And I think it probably gives Demand Justice like far more. It's like a Barbara Streisand effect. It's going to make them seem a lot bit more of a bigger deal than they actually are.
I think Graham probably, he wanted Childs, obviously, but also this gives him a little cover. I think Graham has talked in the past about the importance of, you know, sort of being deferential to a president. If a president nominates somebody who's qualified, Graham, I think his philosophy is that you should vote for them. But I think that this gives Graham an out, that he can,
why
should he can vote against
his. I mean, the one thing you could say about Graham up until this point, and maybe, again, I don't know exactly what he's going to do. He has been consistent on judges, with, I think, the exception of what he said about he made that one comment, I think. I think it was related to jamming through a nominee, and he flipped left on that. But as far as like his actual votes, he has voted. He voted for Kagan. He voted for Sotomayor. And he said, you know, elections have consequences. Essentially, you get your judges, we get our judges.
Right.
You know, I mean, he wasn't even the driving force that denied Merrick Garland a vote. And I suspect if Garland got onto the floor, he might well have voted for Garland. On that principle, although he's probably happy to not have been put in that position, because he likes being able to say that. Yeah. He likes being able to say, you know, I play fair. You guys are mean, but I play fair. So why throw that away? Why throw that away on a pick who is going to get confirmed, not going to upset the ideological balance of the court in any respect, and is a perfectly decent judge with no obvious red flags at all? Why would you go on a big hissy fit for this? I don't get.
Well, I just think that the political zeitgeist on the right has changed, obviously. And so Graham needs to be tougher, more oppositional. And this is now an excuse for him to do that. And he'll pick and choose. That way he gets to be bipartisan when he supports.
Wasn't the zeitgeist more fierce under Obama? when you had a risk of actually flipping, you know, from a, you know, 5-4 conservative to, you know, 5-4 Democrat, you know.
But John McCain was alive back then. John McCain was alive, and it's pretty obvious that Lindsey Graham gravitates to, from like mentor, you know, lodestar to lodestar. And I think as long as McCain was alive, that kind of maverick thing carried the day.
But I mean, outside of Hawley and Cruz, you know, most Republicans aren't in a lather about Jackson.
Yeah.
So I just didn't feel like he had to do this for this pick.
Well, speaking of Hawley, I mean, that was my last Daily Beast piece. My last column was about that. Do you want to, should we talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, I mean, let me just do, I guess, a quick maybe briefing for those who, I'm guessing most people watching or listening are somewhat familiar with this. But basically, last week, Josh Hawley did this sort of Twitter thread where he talked about how he was very concerned about, you know, judge Jackson's past history and comments that she made having to do with child porn.
Right. And he questioned her about this yesterday.
And he did question her about it. And I remember seeing it, and my wife was like, this seems concerning. What, you know, do you, and I'm like, let's wait. Let's just see. This is Josh Hawley. I mean, it looked bad. I gotta be honest. Like, he raised some potentially concerning questions. You know, I reached out sort of behind the scenes to some people I know who are a lot smarter than me on this issue. And they basically were like, this is kind of a nothing burger, mm-hmm. you know, kind of hold your, you keep your powder dry. And mm-hmm. then yesterday, which would be, the first, I guess it was the first Monday. So Monday, which would be the first day of the confirmation hearing, Andy McCarthy at National Review, who is a, you know, really kind of, I would say, he was very pro-Trump, but he was a longtime prosecutor and kind of a legal and law enforcement expert, very frequently on Fox News, you know, so not a squishy rhino, you know, kind of laid out why this is a bogus charge. And you know, there's a lot to it, but basically, you know, the bottom line is that there are these mandatory minimum sentences whereby, you know, if you are someone who is involved in really heinous acts, you would be treated the same as somebody who is a, you know, recipient of this obviously horrible material. And there are other distinctions too, right? Like, so an 18-year-old who receives a text from his 17-year-old girlfriend, mm-hmm. is, should that person who has committed a crime be subject to the mandatory minimums the same as someone who is actually engaging in, like, you know, truly disturbing, graphic, heinous behavior and distributing it widely? And so Judge Jackson, as far as I know, was asking questions about this, which seems to me to be reasonable. And for, you know, for Josh Hawley to use this issue, it also seems a little bit, you know, coincidental or curious, because, as you know, Bill, there's been a movement on the right in recent years to talk about, remember Pizzagate? Mm-hmm. You know, there's mm-hmm. a QAnon thing, basically accusing liberals, mm-hmm. not just progressives, but just mainstream liberals
of being involved. Well, Democrats at the highest levels.
Child rape, yeah. trafficking, mm-hmm. and then most recently this bill down in Florida that Governor DeSantis, I guess, supported. Is that right? It's the so-called
sign in the law, right?
Don't Say Gay yeah. bill, and some DeSantis's people, or at least one of his people, referred to this as a quote anti-grooming bill,
right?
And so we've seen an effort on the right to invoke this idea. And now for Hawley to weaponize this against a individual political target seems to be like an evolution of this technique.
Now, I'm looking at the McCarthy column in the National yeah. Review, where he is again a conservative. Judge Jackson's views on this matter are not only mainstream, they are correct in my view. Undoubtedly, Jackson, a progressive who worked as a criminal defense lawyer, is more sympathetic to criminals than I am. If I were a judge, I'm sure I'd impose at least marginally more severe sentences than she has. Contrary to Hawley's suggestion, however, she appears to have followed the guidelines at the low end of the sentencing range, as most judges do. Other than the fact that Congress wanted to look as though it was being tough on porn, there's no good reason for the mandatory minimum in question, and it's unjust in many instances. The law in question imposes a 5-year mandatory minimum prison sentence and a maximum 20-year term on defendants who receive or distribute pornographic images. By contrast, Congress imposes no mandatory minimum for the crime of possessing such images. This makes little sense, since there's often no meaningful difference between a defendant who collects child porn, yeah. no mandatory minimum, and one who receives images they tend to distribute but hasn't gotten around to distributing, 5-year mandatory minimum.
And Andy McCarthy, it should be noted, is he the guy, I think he wrote a book making the case that we should impeach Obama, right?
I don't remember. Yeah,
he had a book called Faithless Execution, mm-hmm. Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. He's not a rhino. He's not a squid. Mm-hmm. This is a hardcore conservative who is an expert on these issues, who also happens to be intellectually honest. And so this is, I think this is pretty devastating to the case of Josh Hawley. And I believe that Dick Durbin and others cited McCarthy's work, in interviews, and I think actually also during the hearing. So
there's one case that Hawley was really fixated on because it involved someone who owned a lot of child porn, who was 18 years old. Jackson gave him 3 months, and I think a few years after that of other kind of, not imprisonment, but something akin to like probation and help and whatnot. Jackson's point was that this person is 18 and who made a horrible mistake, and she was trying to see if they could get him on the right path.
So I would want to know.
What McCarthy says here, it's not about this case specifically, but he says, generally speaking, because he was a prosecutor himself, generally speaking, we do not prosecute minors federally except for serious violent crimes in the rare instances when we had the jurisdiction to do so. So here was insanity number one. If the offender was a day short of his 18th birthday, we would drop the case. But if it was a day later, we took the case, he'd be looking at a mandatory minimum of several years imprisonment. So it's a weird case. I mean, I'm sure there's other mitigating factors here that Jackson alluded to, and I'm not an expert in it. But it's a very young guy who didn't directly harm an individual because he was in possession, but wasn't distributing, I don't believe, what wasn't being pedophiliac himself in his actions. But obviously, you don't want to look away from the crime. You still want to do something.
Right.
And so she made a judgment call.
I mean, I would want to know what are the ages of the quote unquote children that this 18-year-old is looking at? Mm-hmm. Are these like...
Well, Hawley said prepubescent.
Okay. So that's obviously very concerning. I do think you could have... I think you could have a debate over whether does taking an 18-year-old and putting him in jail with legit other predators, hardened criminals, does that make it? I mean, I know right now there is a legitimate debate taking place because of the whole defund the police argument, because of the rise in crime rate, about being soft on crime, right? And I think that the pendulum has started to swing back toward we need to be a law, we need to be for law and order. We need to throw the book at criminals. Whereas I think a few years ago, it had gone in kind of a criminal justice reform direction. So the pendulum is swinging back, I think, toward a tough on crime approach. I'm not sure who's right on this, but I don't think it is disqualifying to ask a question like, the person that McCarthy just described, like, should that person receive a harsh prison sentence? Is that going to be better? But it's obviously a tough subject. But again, it's weird to me that of all the things Hawley could have brought up, this is his opening bid. Because I don't know that that was anything that defined, Judge Jackson's career or was ever talked about her leading up to this.
Well, I understand Hawley's rationale better than understand Graham's rationale. Graham was someone who for a long time held himself up as someone who was, even Steven on judges. So I feel Graham's being out of character right now. Hawley has been playing to the extreme for a good long while. And
well, Hawley was the first guy to announce publicly that the first senator to announce publicly that he would vote against certifying the election for Biden.
And he raised his fist on January 6th.
Yeah.
And still, even though he says he won't run against, I think he said he won't run against Trump.
He just said he would not run for president in 2024.
Okay.
At all.
But clearly wants to run for president eventually. And I think right now there's two races going on for 2024. There's the race to be the nominee, and there's the race to be Trump's vice presidential nominee. So Holly might well be trying to play for that right now. And then whatever happens with Trump, go for it in 2028. So being, you know, doing a little wink, wink to the QAnon folks by making a huge deal about Jackson's record on sexual predators and child pornography, you know, that makes perfect political sense. I mean, if you think that's your ticket, I mean, you still could argue like you're playing to a very, very, you know, thin slice of the electorate, and you're discrediting yourself with the broad middle in the process. So maybe what you're doing is not smart. I understand that argument too. But Hawley's clearly made the conclusion that this is where the energy of the Republican base is, and that's what's going to catapult him to the presidency.
Well, it is. You know, it's disturbing, but I do, you know, I should, I referenced the Borking earlier, but you know, because I'm sitting in ostensibly the conservative chair, I should note that, you know, Democrats kind of went there first. You know, I hate that this bullshit is happening, and I don't think we should do it. I don't think Republicans or conservatives should do it, but. You know, in the past, I think there were, you know, highly qualified conservative nominees that Democrats and the left decided, like, the only way we could stop them is by some sort of character assassination and leveling charges about sexual misconduct. In the case of Kavanaugh, you know, he was even accused. Remember, the Michael Avenatti accused him of gang rape. You know, so I guess this is just maybe this is where we are, that every, you know, it seems like the Amy Coney Barrett was pretty mild. There was an effort to portray her as being kind of like a religious fanatic at some point. You know, the people of praise thing in her Catholic faith. People were kind of making fun of her big family and suggesting that I guess there was some suggestion that there was some hypocrisy, I guess, because. Ostensibly her faith believes that women ought to know their place. And yet here she is, you know, who's watching Amy Coney Barrett's children during the hearing or whatever. But I think Barrett pretty much got off pretty easy. It wasn't too ugly, but by and large, I mean, this is kind of the new normal, right?
Well, you may not be aware, Matt. You said I had a tweet the other day, which read Senate Republic. This is right. I think it was at the beginning of the hearing. Senate Republicans have a 6-3 Supreme Court and still act like they've been treated unfairly in the nominations game. Just an amazing commitment to grievance politics. Yeah. And this guy, I mean, this is like a total throwaway tweet. It's gotten 5,000 retweets at this point. Because it clearly, you know, it strikes a nerve on the left that Republicans can't let go of all these instances. I mean, you know, Bork got defeated. But, you know, Kavanaugh's on the court. Amy Coney Barrett's on the court. Clarence Thomas is on the court. And what I think is, what I think sort of folks on the right don't appreciate, generally speaking.
I would say this, though. When the Bork thing happened, I think it also does have a chilling effect whereby future nominees. It's like let's nominate someone who can get through without.
But Bork was not, by and large, a character assassination project. The Ted Kennedy speech at the front of the nomination was excessive, and I think, you know, went beyond the facts. But and it obviously set a very, you know, sour tone for Bork supporters. But I think the Biden-led hearings themselves were on the level. And he was defeated, not filibuster, he was defeated on up or down vote because of his actual record. I mean, it was an unusual case because people had not made judicial philosophy a criteria up until that point. And so
he was qualified in terms of credentials and resume.
And I agree with you. That there was a very long ripple effect from that, in that conservatives spent a long time trying to, those who wanted to get on to rise in the judiciary, kind of cloaking their philosophy, not writing law review articles that said too much, kept things very close to the vest, so you couldn't get, you know, dinged at a hearing. And I think that that changed with Alito. You know, that changed when Bush put up Harriet Myers and conservatives said, okay, we're done playing this game. Okay, John Roberts, okay, we let you have Roberts who played a coy, but we want people who are proven conservatives and we have the numbers to get our way now. And that has been, and that's been proven true, that the conservatives, plenty of people have gotten on the court with long paper trails at this point. So what I think that, and this is a separate point. So if you want to respond to that, I'll stop. I'll make one other point if you're
well, ready. I'll just interject one point that's related. Bork was this intellectual, curmudgeon, eccentric. And I like people. I think people like that are kind of fun and interesting. And I think that one maybe underrated change is after Bork, the Republicans that are nominated are more young Republican looking, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like a clean cut, you know, I mean, I guess Scalia would be the exception. I mean, Scalia is sort of, it was this kind of eccentric. Mm-hmm. I mean, he smoked like a pipe during the hearings, but by and large, I think that one of the shifts went away from sort of that grandiose mm-hmm. style to people who were more clean cut, mm-hmm. Ivy, you know.
And Scalia was confirmed before Bork.
Central. Okay, perfect. Okay, then my point stands. Central casting since then.
The other point I would make is I think conservatives, Republicans don't appreciate this. Every time for a Supreme Court nominee that Democrats have gone in full bore to try to stop them, it's always with the understanding that if we somehow manage to defeat this nomination, Republicans are going to get another pick. They're going to get a judge. We're not going to actually get a Democratic judge out of this process. I think in the case of Bork, people wanted to have a more mainstream type of Republican than a far right Republican. But I think with Clarence Thomas and also with Brett Kavanaugh, it was much more about trying to set a standard about treatment of women. Now, obviously, people can make the argument that they were trumped up charges that were unfair. I mean, if you, that's what you believe, that's what you believe. But I don't think it's accurate to say that Democrats, progressives, feminists said, let's concoct a fake charge and destroy this person's reputation just so Bush Sr. or Donald Trump can get a different person nominated. There's always an understanding that it's going to be a Republican pick at the end of the day, but they're trying to set a different standard with who should get that pick. And again, if you think, I mean, like, you know, I mean, Avenatti's, like the Avenatti charge, I think was the weakest of the charge against Kavanaugh, but it wasn't the primary charge against Kavanaugh. It was the thing that folks used to end up saving him and make everything else seem discredited. What I hear a lot from conservatives is, you know, sure, we blocked Merrick Garland, but we didn't drag him through the mud. We didn't destroy his reputation. And that's, I mean, that's true. He was killed very gently. He was killed all classy-like by just not giving him a hearing. But the political import of that was you literally took a Democratic pick and made a Republican pick. And that's something the Democrats have never, ever accomplished with all the things going on.
One, if your goal is to overturn Roe versus Wade, for example, there's not a big difference between getting John Sununu or Sotomayor, mm-hmm. right? And so, yes, we got a Republican nominee, but—
You mean David Souter, I think.
What did I say?
John Sununu.
Okay. Sununu got Souter the nomination. Right. Thank you for that catch. If your goal is to overturn Roe versus Wade, there's not a huge difference between getting Souter or getting Sotomayor. So It makes a huge difference if you block the conservative pick. The other thing I would say is, there was a Hispanic judge that was nominated by Republicans to the circuit court.
Miguel Estrada.
Okay. So Miguel Estrada, that is somebody that Democrats openly blocked because they feared he would be the first Hispanic on the Supreme Court.
Well, I know that's the charge and may well have been the underlying motivation, but the overt complaint was that he worked in the Bush administration. They wanted to see all of his records, and the Bush didn't want to cough him up.
But wasn't, I mean, I don't know how substantiated this is, but I'd have to do a little research. But like, as I recall, Chuck Schumer said, or was reported that Chuck Schumer said, we're going to block him so he doesn't make it to the Supreme Court.
I don't call it. I'm not saying it's wrong. But I'd be pretty sure that was something that was reportedly said, not like Chuck Schumer going right into the TV cameras and saying that outright.
Right. I think that's fair. Because I can't Google it now, I'll put an asterisk beside that. But I guess the point being, I think that you know, Democrats, when they have blocked conservative nominees, there are consequences sometimes because the subsequent nominee is not as conservative. And also, I do think that that there is politics is at play here to a certain degree. I'm not saying that that's the sole driver behind why they would level a charge against somebody. But I would say, you know, in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, I mean, without relitigating that entire thing. And by the way, I felt like, after I watched the hearing, I felt like the charge, who was the woman who leveled the charge that he like attacked her at a party, or, you know, I can't even remember her name.
Christine Ford.
Right. Blasey.
Yeah.
Ford.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, honestly, after I heard her testimony, I felt like she at least believes this happened, whether it happened or not, she believes it. And then after I watched Brett Kavanaugh, I felt like, oh, wow, I believe him. So, I mean, I'm not saying that they were crazy to believe her charge or to give her a hearing, but my recollection of that is, the hearings were over, and then this charge came out of nowhere. And like, it just seems to me that anytime you want to stop a guy from a big job, a promotion or whatever, you could level a charge like that at the 11th hour and possibly blow the whole thing up. And so,
And I understand that concern because it's very hard in the heat of a confirmation hearing, which is a roughly time constrained, that you drop a very incendiary charge that can be hard to vet at the last minute. You know, that on the surface looks like dirty pool.
I don't think
Ford didn't wait to the last minute. You know, there's a whole backstory about how the thing, you know, got out. Obviously, if you're making your allegations well before a nomination occurs, it's going to seem more credible. And people who are suspicious are going to say, hey, you only bring this up because the person got nominated. Yeah. This is a political hit.
In fairness to Holly, he says that's why he put it out last week. Right. Because he didn't want,
it's like a year in advance. I mean, she was up for a nomination before he didn't say anything.
But it's, you know, if he had dropped it the day after the hearings ended, right before the vote, you know, that would have been even less cool.
But nevertheless, if you don't like the way that has been conducted, I understand. But even still, Clarence Thomas got past it and has been on the court for decades. In fact, is in the middle of, I would argue, very credible conflict of interest charges involving his wife and January 6th. Still there. Brett Kavanaugh is not only there, but has even voted sometimes, you know, with the liberal justices on occasion. Has even been like a hardcore, reliable vote for conservatives, though, you know, pretty close, but not all the way there. It's not like every time Kavanaugh casts a vote that the charges get recirculated. He's on the court and is having a good career. So, like, the problem that conservatives are mad about, they have found a way to overcome, and yet they're still mad. And so that's what I have a hard time accepting. Like, you have addressed this challenge. You found a way to lock arms and put those charges, stuff them back, you know, down the Democrats' throats and get your people on the court, and yet you're still mad. And why should that have any impact on how you judge Judge Jackson? You know, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Look, and I got to go soon. We got to wrap. But I would agree, two wrongs don't make a right. Even if you assume it was a wrong before, you shouldn't, you know, we ought to be better. You know, conservatives have a hell of a lot of things to, like, the fact that I would summon us to be better is not surprising. We need to be better. And so, look, she seems highly qualified. She seems like a nice person. If you want to vote against her based on philosophy, even, I think that's now okay. You know, it's no longer just qualified. It's if you want to vote against her based on her philosophy, by all means, I probably would. But let's not be jerks about it. And let's not be unfair about it. And so I have not seen anything from anybody I respect that would, and that's anything outrageous that would lead me to believe that she's not who we think she is. I mean, she's not going to be Scalia. She's not going to be Barrett. Okay. I mean, that's, you know, the elections have consequences. And so that's where we are. And, you know, it's time to grow up, conservatives, as your hero Barry Goldwater might say.
So how many Republican votes does she get?
Two.
Two?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of premature to guess because the hearings aren't over yet.
So why did you ask me?
Well, because I'm mean. But right now, I would say more than two.
Okay. So that's the over-under, I guess, as they would say in gambling.
I don't know about Graham. I feel like I can't count on Graham at this point. But I also feel like Graham is no longer a bellwether because he's just so weird. I think there'll be enough Republicans who'll say this is a free vote. This is a chance to say, look at us, we're better than you, Democrats. Knowing that you know, this is not Merrick Garland, this is not replacing a swing, it's not creating a shift in the ideological balance of the court. So do a freebie, pat yourself on the back that you were the good guys. I think you'll get a few more than two for that.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on that and we'll see who's right. I got some stuff to plug. You got anything, Bill?
Not really, but you go.
Okay. So I just I mentioned my Daily Beast column where I talked about the Josh Hawley thing, and so check that out. I also did a piece at the Beast last week where I talked about quote unquote insider trading among Congress, where it seems like whatever the crisis is, whether it's, you know, the Great Recession or COVID or now Russia's invasion of Ukraine, members of Congress find a way to make money in the stock market. So check that out. Let's see, two really cool podcasts this week. Cedric Layton, who is a CNN military analyst, came on. I'm getting ready to post that one. And this is cool, Bill. I talked to John Popper of Blues Traveler, and we got into a lot of stuff, including politics. He's a libertarian. He went to a Ron Paul rally that kind of freaked him out and turned him off to Ron Paul. But we had a good conversation, and you could check all that out at Matt Lewis and the News. And I posted the segment specifically about politics because we talked about a lot of stuff, but I just posted the political stuff to my YouTube page. It's youtube.com/Matt Lewis. You can go and watch that part of the discussion. I think it's about 7 minutes long.
All right. So check those out, and I will see you soon back here in the DMZ.
You got it. Thanks, Bill. See you guys. Bye.